From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, before you salt your sidewalk or your driveway, a soil scientist asks you to pause and consider salt's impact.
Later, with the NFL playoffs starting, our sports contributor has an unpopular prediction about the Packers-Giants game and its quarterbacks.
If Eli Manning can just not turn the ball over, I still don't see Green Bay getting out of the first round. Rodgers can be Rodgers, but their defense might come back to get them, and this time they're not playing a team that's going to give up a lot of yards.
We'll explore a unique collection of high-flying artwork.
And a local writer explores the history of Milwaukee's unique address tiles.
I'd been for years just noticing the address tiles, and after a few years of casually noticing them, I decided to actually look into this and see, you know, what the story was.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. None of us probably need to be reminded of the Arctic blast that has us in its grip this week. We're also accustomed to bouts of snow and ice in Wisconsin winter.
However, the Soil Science Society of America hopes that when it comes to the ice, we'll think twice about the salt that's commonly applied to driveways and sidewalks.
The group says the salt that blows off pavement or flows away with melting ice and snow is wreaking havoc on soil systems and, in turn, on the plants that depend on them. Too much sodium, the society says, and soils cannot retain important plant nutrients.
Lake Effect Susan Bentz reached soil scientist Mary Tiedemann to learn more. She's currently working on her PhD in soil microbiology at Florida International University. Tiedemann began by explaining why she gravitated to the world of soils.
It started with a field trip. I was able to do a study abroad trip in Ghana with a soils professor at Iowa State. And I was an environmental science student at the time, but the focus of this 3 or 4 week trip was natural resource management and the impact of land management on soil quality. And I went on this trip and was absolutely addicted, came back and signed up to be a part of the agronomy department immediately afterwards.
That's really cool. Talk to us about the basics of soil composition.
Sure. So there is a mineral composition as well as organic matter, which people probably hear a lot about. It's kind of the glue that keeps everything together, as well as an organism factor. But mainly put, there's a mineral component, there's an organic component, and then oxygen and gases, as well as water. And those things all comprise soil.
So a balance of those, the right proportions, is the magic.
Yes, exactly.
So then what happens when in our part of the world, not in Miami, Florida,
sure,
ice and snow can be prevalent, and a common treatment is salt.
So some complications that can arise. One very important aspect of soils is its structure. So you can think of structure being, we call them aggregates, but they're crumbles of soil. So a really healthy topsoil is going to almost look like cookie crumbles. And when salt enters the picture, particularly sodium ion, they can create a chemical reaction, which essentially makes the aggregates fall apart. And these aggregates are really important because they allow water to infiltrate through the soil. They allow roots to grow without any inhibition, as well as a gas exchange. So roots give off CO2, but they need oxygen, and having very loose, healthy soil aggregates allows for the movement of all of these different things that are essential for plants and animals.
Does that salt stick around if it is present? If it does find its way into soils, is it there indefinitely, or what does it take for the soil to rid itself of the presence and the impacts of salt?
Sure. So it takes several years, and this is all dependent on the texture of your soil. So if you're in an area where the soils are very high in clay, then it will take longer for the salt to wash out. And this is because clay particles are very fine and have a very high surface area. And so it's much more difficult for water to flow through soils that are high in clay. And essentially, the magical formula involves the amount of water that is able to flow through the soil system. Because the water essentially is what carries excess sodium out of the soil profile. So anywhere from a few years, if you have consistent and fairly steady rain, but if you were in a drought situation, that sodium will stay in your soils much longer.
It seems like a double-edged sword in a way, Mary, because you don't want to damage your soil. On the other hand, you need to treat roads and sidewalks often in some way because you don't want people slipping and sliding and hurting themselves.
Sure, of course.
But then also, if that is used, that it's either going to be in the soil and or make its way into a water system, right?
Sure.
And that comes with downsides as well.
Definitely. Yeah. Our article didn't cover any of the issues with water impairment, but that's also a very big issue. But I suppose the best guidance that we can give is everything in moderation. That ultimately, if you can do your best to limit the amount of salt that you use in your driveways and sidewalks, the better. And if you're concerned about your yard, there are ways that you can limit the movement of salt into your yard, whether it be by planting shrubs that are more salt tolerant or applying salt in a particular way that can limit its movement. There are tips that can give you the best of both worlds, I suppose.
I also read being proactive about shoveling and the use of kitty litter or sand for traction. How well does the kitty litter or sand figure in as a solution or as an alternative?
Well, so kitty litter and sand, they serve a different purpose. They don't melt the ice like salt will, but they assist in traction, in building traction. So there may be ice on your roads, but they won't be as treacherous to walk on or to drive on. There is also a way that you can apply salt to your roads by just adding a little bit of moisture to them. I did a bit of a calculation before you called, and for 1 pound of salt, you would only need about 1 or 2 ounces of water to mix with the salt before you apply onto your sidewalks and roads. And that will allow the salt to stick to the area that you intend for it to work. And it also kind of activates the road salt and makes it more effective, which in turn allows you to use less of it.
So you're a member of the Soil Science Society of America?
Yes, I am.
It's pretty interesting. It was founded in 1936, and it's based in Madison, but its membership is international, I believe. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, worldwide.
When I read soil is the reservoir in which most of life on Earth depends, it's compelling. Whether it's your yard where ecosystems should or you hope are alive to agricultural fields.
Yeah, we soil scientists are pretty motivated. We're as a soil scientist, I recognize that there's a lot of work to be done in all different avenues of studying this natural resource, whether it's soil biology or the impact that humans have on soils, whether it be our application of road salt or urbanization, the production of food. There's so many different exciting topics revolving around soils that it's keeping a lot of us busy and excited.
So is there a tidbit or something you've learned about soils that you find just utterly fascinating that might make people think about salt and other ways they treat their soil?
One of my favorite fun facts is that there are more soil microorganisms in a teaspoon of healthy soil than there are people on this planet.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So you probably didn't think you'd be talking about salt at this point in your career.
Well, I've been a native Iowan my entire life. I was born and raised in Iowa. And so I've only been in Miami since August, but it seems a little funny that it's not until now that I get to start writing about wintry, wintry weather. But
life is full of surprises.
Yeah. Well, and it's nice to know that all of these experiences throughout my life can still be applied.
Absolutely.
Hopefully people can trust someone living in Florida to tell them about road salt.
I think so. You did a great job.
Thank you very much.
Mary Tiedemann is a member of the Soil Science Society of America and is currently a PhD student at Florida International University in Miami. She spoke with WUWM's Susan Benz.
You'll find a list of tips on reducing impacts of salt on your soil, as well as a link to Tiedemann's blog post on the subject on our website, WUWM.com.
Though the interstate is choking under salt and dirty sand, and it seems the sun is hiding.
The soil will be frozen tundra-like in Green Bay this weekend as the Packers open the NFL playoffs. We'll preview the game with our sports contributor when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
So give it a rest, girl. Take a deep breath, girl. Meet me at the Bay State tonight. And the snow is coming down on our New England town. It's been falling all day long. What else is
new? Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. The Arctic weather outbreak is expected to stick around through the weekend in Milwaukee, which gives football fans a good excuse to stay indoors on Sunday afternoon.
As though they needed a good excuse, the Packers, winners of six in a row, play in the marquee playoff game of the weekend, taking on the New York Giants on Sunday late afternoon. And that is where we start our conversation with Sean Ramft, managing editor of the website, The Sports Post. Hi, Sean. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So the last time we spoke, the Packers were in the midst of really kind of flailing around. We talked about their upcoming game with the Washington Redskins. Things did not look good, and indeed, they didn't turn out well. But since then, completely different story. What is behind this turnaround?
I'm pretty sure, simply put, it's Aaron Rodgers. I know we talked about last time how he had not been quite right. And then, of course, he says, hey, we could run the table. And they did just that. He's probably been the best quarterback in the league over the last 6 weeks. A lot of MVP consideration suddenly after the first, several weeks where that wasn't a thing. But yeah, the offense is firing on all cylinders, and they have made up for all the injuries on defense, which keep mounting.
So. Right. It seems like their offense has been just good enough to offset any trouble they're having on defense.
Yes. He's been himself again. Ty Montgomery at running back in flashes has been excellent.
Especially considering he's a wide receiver.
Yes. Can't wait for him to be an actual running back and go through the offseason as one, because I'm pretty sure that's what's going to happen. And
yeah, nobody's really lamenting the loss of Eddie Lacy at
no,
this point.
No, which is, I would like to see him back, and it's probably going to be cheap. Because, this was going to be his contract year, and he was set to have a big season, and the injury derailed that. And they picked up Christine Michael from the Seahawks, who was released. He'll probably be back, too. That leaves James Starks as the odd man out. But, Rodgers has been Rodgers, and Devontae Adams has stepped up. Jordy Nelson is catching touchdowns again. And like I said last time, the NFC North is bad, and the Vikings cooled off a lot. The Bears are very, very bad. And the Lions, they made the playoffs too, but they could have run away with the division, and they lost a couple down the stretch after Stafford's injury. So.
And in the end, the Lions only made the playoffs because the Redskins lost.
Yes. They wouldn't have made it if the Giants beat them this past Sunday. So once again, the Packers win the North. almost the same story as every single season, which is probably getting annoying for the rest of the NFC North fans out there, especially the Vikings, who started 5-0. But it's been mostly Aaron Rodgers. So
all right, so let's talk about what the Packers' outlook is, because they ran the table. As we said, their offense was good enough to offset the difficulties they've had on defense. So what does that mean come playoff time? They start the playoffs against the Giants.
Yeah, they start at home, which is always, good. But the Giants, both times, their last two trips to the Super Bowl, they've beaten Green Bay to get there.
Giants make the case that nobody wants to play them.
Yeah.
Some of that is bravado, obviously.
Sure.
But when it comes playoff time, the Giants are a tough team.
Yeah, and they've gotten hot at the right time, like Green Bay has. You can make the case that nobody wants to play Green Bay right now, but the big difference is defense, and the Giants have it in abundance, and the Packers do not. Their secondary is decimated. They lost a couple more corners this past week.
This is the Packers,
yeah. They had a couple more corners missed last week. They've already signed one or two from the practice squad. They're thin, and Clay Matthews is healthy, which is rare this year, but that won't be enough, and the Giants' defense is great. And if Eli Manning can just not turn the ball over, I still don't see Green Bay getting out of the first round. Rodgers can be Rodgers, but their defense might come back to get them. And this time they're not playing a team that's going to give up a lot of yards, in theory at least.
But the Packers have surprised before, so we'll have to see.
Yeah, it'd be a nice surprise.
So let's talk about the playoffs in general. And we look at the NFC, we look at the AFC. The NFC is a much deeper conference, it seems, this year.
Yeah, you got the Cowboys who, weirdly enough, two of their three losses are against the Giants, and that could come up down the road. The Seahawks are always trouble.
Seahawks have had a very inconsistent year, but
it's
playoff
the playoffs,
time, yeah.
Like the Giants, it's always going to be. The Lions could surprise them Saturday. I don't think they will. I think the Stafford injury really derailed their season. He was doing really well, and it's not like he had a bad last few weeks, but he's just maybe their strength of schedule caught up to him. Maybe the injury's taken more out of him than we thought it would. But yeah, the NFC looks pretty good. Not a lot of great records in there, but looks pretty good.
And the AFC, it seems like a fairly thin group of teams. I will speak on behalf of my Patriots.
You've got your New England Patriots.
They, as much as I feel like I jinx them by saying this, they have to be the odds-on favorite in the AFC right now, especially given what happened in Oakland.
Yes, which is a bummer. Not necessarily that the Patriots are favorites, which could also be construed as a bummer. But
I think Patriots fans and Packers fans kind of understand each other.
Yeah, we're pretty much the same. We always successful, at least the last 10, 15 years or so. But the Patriots, hard to bet against them ever, even without Brady in the four games this year. And that was without Gronk for the most part, too, who's done for the rest of the year. They went 3-1 with two different quarterbacks. Their defense is sound. And if Brady's healthy, there's really, under Belichick, there's nobody better, usually.
Well, so talk about the Raiders, because the Raiders were a surprising team for the first 14 weeks of the season.
And Derek Carr was great. He was sort of in the MVP conversation. And now we get to see, is it Connor Cook?
I believe that's right.
Oakland's Connor Cook, their third stringer.
Who, it should be noted, was a pick higher than Dak Prescott.
Yes, who is obviously very good this year. I don't think the Raiders stand a chance. Their best bet now is that at least they play Houston to open the postseason, who, like the Giants, have a great defense, but unlike the Giants, don't
have
really
Brock
have
Brock Osweiler at quarterback.
Yeah, who it was going to be Tom Savage, who's already looking better than Brock Osweiler, and then he got a concussion. So that game's going to be a mess, probably. Probably really fun defensive battle. I can see Oakland sneaking through, but after that, almost every team is stronger. The Steelers should win their first game. Miami's without Ryan Tannehill now. He's ruled out for Sunday. But after that, I mean, it's the Patriots' conference to lose. And the Raiders, it's unfortunate because I could have seen them go into the AFC title game against New England.
It certainly would have been an interesting dynamic
yeah.
had the Raiders been as healthy as they were for the first 14 games.
As long as Derek Carr would have been healthy, they would have had a real shot in making some noise in the playoffs.
So your thoughts at this stage of the game for who we might see in the Super Bowl?
I want to say New England, which isn't hard to say. Mm-hmm. And as much as I would like to see the Packers in there, I don't think it's going to happen. A New England-New York rematch for the third time would be fun for some people. I don't think it's going to be Dallas. I know that seems to be the thing, is New England-Dallas. They have Tony Romo as a backup, though. I just don't know if they can get through the postseason with two rookies leading the way. So I'm going to go Seattle, because they're always
Thinking of Seattle, annoyingly New England.
Pesky. It could be Seattle, New England again, even though they've been really inconsistent down the stretch. I'll say Seattle, New England. Rematch of a couple of years ago.
You just never know what's going to happen. That's why they play the games.
Yes. Let's go Chiefs. Chiefs Giants in the Super Bowl for fun, maybe alternate.
Not a Chiefs Packers rematch of Super Bowl
One. That'd be cool too, actually. Any of those.
All right, so let's turn our attention to basketball. And as we have this conversation, the Bucks are coming off of a really thrilling victory. Yeah. Last second, Giannis Antetokounmpo shot to beat the Knicks. And the Bucks, actually, Giannis on the cover of Sports Illustrated this week, too.
Look at that. Milwaukee Bucks getting some national attention. It's nice for someone like me who hasn't, until recently, paid that closely of attention to the NBA since the last time the Bucks were relevant, which was years ago.
I wonder if that's the story around Milwaukee right now.
Yeah, it's fun. They're an exciting team. They have a lot of young potential stars. You could already say that Giannis is at the star level and only getting bigger. Jabari Parker is developing really nicely. Just all the little pieces they have around them seem to be fitting in, too. Greg Monroe coming off the bench has been a nice addition. Last year, he didn't really fit in when they signed him to that contract, but he took a six-man role, and he's running with it. It's been pretty fun. The East is always a little shaky near the bottom half of the top eight.
It's kind of the AFC of the NBA.
Yeah, right now. And for the longest time, I guess. And right now, the Bucks are right in that 5-8 seed. I know there was like a game and a half separating teams 5-8. And this is all with Chris Middleton out for most of the season. He won't be back until later he's recovering from his hamstring tear. And Giannis has just been, it's just fun to watch him. It's fun to watch basketball here, which is nice.
Well, and as you say, the East is one of those places where you could, you know, end the season three games over 500 and get the 4 or 5 seed.
Oh, yeah, right now. Right now you could probably finish 500, yeah, and get 5. Seed 8, you could probably finish 2 to 3 under or a few more. I know in the West, 1 through 7 seems to be really solid, and then the 8 seed is like 6 games under, but the East is pretty much the same way except 5 through 8. So
at this point, we can look at the Bucks, and this is a playoff team.
Yes. Yeah, they should make the playoffs with this roster. I know a lot of fans probably in Milwaukee always like to undersell the Bucks, and for the most part, that's entirely accurate of how they've been the last decade and a half, but this team should make the playoffs in the East. You could even see them getting out of the first round. I don't know if they go much further than that this year, but if they have everybody healthy next year and they tie down, you know, their studs, then they're looking really good.
Well, and so there's the question I have for you. If you're a team that is building a new arena and trying to put some momentum into the team before that arena gets here, this seems like it has to be going, and again, I'm afraid of jinxing here, this seems to be going exactly the way they would want it to.
Yes. And I can't imagine they won't tie down Giannis and Parker. And they already did Middleton. They just got to keep that core intact. And they've made a little bit of a few questionable decisions with paying all of their centers a lot of money, that they have too many centers to use. That Plumlee contract is still very odd. He barely plays, and he's making upwards of, what, $50 million over the next 4 seasons. Good for him. Great gig if he can.
Sure, he has a nice car.
Yeah. Henson's been good off the bench in rotation. I know their first-round pick this past season, Thon Maker, they're going to bring along slowly. He's a lot rawer than Giannis was, which is saying a lot.
And for people who don't know him, he is he the first NBA player from South Sudan? Is that right?
I believe so, yeah. And that pick surprised a lot of people because at first he was a top 10 guy because he was so young and had all this potential. Now then there were questions about his age. But their second-round pick, Brogdon, is, you know, in the rookie of the year conversation now. He's 2 years older than Giannis. He leads or is very close to leading in all the major categories among rookies. I still think it'll go to Embiid in Philly just because, I mean, he plays, you know, he gets starters minutes and he's been really good as well. Even though they drafted him a few seasons ago, he hasn't played until this year. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. A lot of bright young stars. It's nice. I hope they don't do what they did several years ago and start trading everybody off a few years down the road. This is
Different ownership.
Different ownership. They're doing things a little differently, and it looks pretty exciting.
Well, and if nothing else, we in Milwaukee are not yet counting the days until spring training, which is saying something.
Not right now. Yeah, we actually have basketball to keep us excited.
Sean, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Ranft is managing editor of the website The Sports Post and our regular sports contributor.
If the Packers playoff game this weekend doesn't exhaust your taste for spectacle, Monday offers the first in a series of opportunities to catch some lively conversation and music.
Milwaukee Magazine launches its MilMag Live series in partnership with Lake Effect at Colectivo's back room. Editor-in-Chief Carol Nixon joins us in the studio to give us a little backstory. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
Milwaukee Magazine is a print publication. Why did you want it to jump off the page and into a live event series?
You know, I think that, especially today, it can seem a little bit one-sided to just put out this print publication and that's it. And then you go on and do it the same thing the next month. And there's so many great stories and more importantly, great ideas that go into each issue. And I really want the magazine to be the jumping off point for a conversation with the community, an exchange of ideas. And I also want those ideas in turn to find their way back into the magazine for future stories. So I think there's so many opportunities, and beyond the exchange of ideas, I think there's a lot of opportunity for fun. So to that end, we're going to also incorporate musical acts and perhaps storytellers and who knows what as things evolve. But I just think that there's so many possibilities to make the magazine into more of a happening.
And we should note that we're doing this in partnership with each other.
Yes.
Lake Effect is part of this series. It sounds like the vibe is very much a fun activity versus this is not a lecture series.
Not at all. I mean, well, for instance, the first one that happens this coming Monday, January 9th, that one is based on our feature story in the January issue, which is conversations. So we paired up a lot of different people, and we're bringing back some of those people to talk on two separate topics, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But the idea is not for it to be them talking at you. We want audience participation. We'll try to do things to make that happen. And we want everyone to come and have a good time, but to interact.
So let's talk about the two topics that are at the heart, or the parallel hearts, if you will, of this first event. And the first of them is the idea of insiders versus outsiders. What are you hoping to answer here?
Well, you know, that topic came up in a conversation between Chief Flynn and the chef Heather Terhune, who was on Top Chef, and she's the head chef at Tre Rivali now here in Milwaukee. And they're both from out of town, as am I, as are you.
As am I, yes.
And they were talking about, you know, just different things they've noticed about Milwaukee, et cetera, et cetera. But that sparked, it harkened back to conversations I've had with other people. And I'd like that conversation to start at the point of what do outsiders bring to Milwaukee, and what infusion of ideas are outsiders responsible for, versus what type of energy do the insiders, the people who've been here all their lives, what are they doing to move the needle forward? And I don't want to make it argumentative, but if it gets a little bit argumentative, that's fun too. So I'd like to explore those things, and also the perceptions of outsiders versus the perceptions of insiders, as well as whatever else comes up.
Well, right. There seems like no end of conversation that could be had about the nature of being an insider or an outsider in Milwaukee. The second half of the conversation, there's a musical interlude, I believe. And then the second half is on the creative class.
Yes. So again, we had a couple of different conversations that appear in the magazine. But a theme that emerged from those conversations was that there seems to be a feeling that the creative class is on the brink of something big here in Milwaukee. And what that something is, I'm not sure whether it's sort of exploding into more of a national scene or just becoming so vibrant that maybe it becomes a bigger attraction to people from across the United States to move here. I don't know exactly what that is, but that's what we want to find out. We want to bring these people together and figure out what's happening here.
And there is interactivity here. The audience participates in these conversations.
Yes. So I hope everyone listening will come, and I hope they'll come with their own ideas that they express and join in the conversation.
And we should note that the conversations may well be excerpted on Lake Effect in the days to come. Who are the musical guests this time around?
Oh, I'm very excited about that. So it's a trio, and they're called Negative Positive, and they're actually preteens, and they just released their first EP. And, you know, we're going to get them home by bedtime, and I can't wait to hear them rock out.
Outstanding. I don't know if you want to spring it on people. Do you have anything you can share about subsequent events?
Absolutely. In February, the topic to go along with a feature that we're running in that issue is Branding Milwaukee. Who the hell are we anyway? And for that panel, we're going to have a couple of voices from the community who have thought about branding, whether it should be water, whether it should be the arts. But we're also going to try to pull together some advertising executives and play a little game where they bring out their ideas of what our brand should be. And we're hoping that the audience will come with some ideas of their own, and we could play around with all of that.
Maybe a little jingle writing.
I would love some jingle writing. Do you have a jingle ready for
Not
us?
Not off the top of my head. Sorry,
yes,
I wasn't
you
prepared.
You have a little time to work on it, because that one will be February 13th. Our musical guest that week is Luke Cerny. He's a really good guitar player. Very excited to have him. And
maybe
so,
we should leave the jingle writing to him.
I'm going to ask him for a jingle.
Well, it is an exciting time, and we're looking forward to being a part of it. Carol Nixon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carol Nixon is editor-in-chief at Milwaukee Magazine. The first MilMag live event in partnership with Lake Effect is Monday evening at the Colectivo Backroom on the east side. The event benefits the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, and you can find a link to ticket information at WUWM.com.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear about an art collection in Oshkosh that once flew high in the sky. Lake Effect returns with that story in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. World War II was fought by land, by sea, and, of course, by air. If you've ever seen pictures of the planes that fought in World War II, you've probably seen the iconic paintings that often adorned the front or nose of the plane.
An unrivaled collection of nose art is currently on display at the EAA Air Venture Museum in Oshkosh. And the story of how the collection came to be is as interesting as the story of the art itself.
Dick Napinski is the museum's communications director, and he joins us in the studio to share both stories. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
So we've all probably seen, if not in person, then pictures of this kind of iconic nose art that adorned fighter planes in World War II and bomber and a variety of planes. But if I understand it correctly, the military actually prohibited it. So how did this art end up on the airplanes?
Well, that's kind of interesting, Mitch, because you're right. The military officially had policy against it. In fact, the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, wasn't very fond of it when she saw it back in England. But it was a morale boost. You're figuring you had 19, 20, 21-year-old guys. If you were 25 on an airbase in England in World War II, they called you gramps because you were just, you were the old guy. And so what did you think of when you're a 19, 20, 21-year-old guy? You thought of the girlfriend back home. You thought of your hometown. You thought of Hollywood starlets. And maybe, you know, Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny and things like that. So pretty soon they started decorating the noses of the airplane using paint and oil and motor oil sometimes and everything else they could find to do it. And so the generals kind of looked the other way a little bit, and it became iconic art, became very well-known art for both the folks on the air bases and the people back home.
The idea here is that if you're a 19, 20, 21-year-old soldier, you're already kind of uneasy about what you're about to do. This maybe puts you a little bit more at ease as you climb onto the airplane.
It certainly is. And the other thing is, it became your airplane. Not only the flight crew, but the ground crew as well. That was your airplane. And so it was an identifying mark. It became part of the personality of the crew in the airplane and the ground crew as well.
Well, so it's hard for me to imagine that all of these 19, 20, and 21-year-olds were talented artists. Who was it that painted these things?
Usually they designated somebody on the crew, whoever was the artist who showed some skill or somebody that said, I could do it. Okay, show us. And so they would start drawing and they'd say, yeah. One of the big complications was you have a flat surface. Let's say you've got Betty Grable as a pinup, and now you have to, on a curved piece of metal, try to recreate that. That's why most of the time they were pretty good. Sometimes, though, they were a little bit lopsided in places. So, you know, it was one of those things. They did the best they could with what they had, but it was a reminder of home and really something that connected them back with the home front.
What did they have? Because there were shortages of everything during World War II.
There was. You had some paint on the air bases, mostly in England at the time, sometimes in North Africa and so forth. You had motor oil. You had starch. You had food coloring. You had anything that you could scrape up that would create a certain pigment, whether you needed a red, whether you needed a green, whatever it was. And so you used what you could and mixed it together and got something that looked like paint and stuck like paint and then put it on the side of the airplanes.
So for people who aren't necessarily as familiar with nose art, you mentioned, you know, Betty Grable and various pinups. What other sorts of things did soldiers paint on their airplanes?
Well, there were, of course, girlfriends. There were Hollywood starlets. But hometowns, there are things, Memphis Belle comes to mind, City of Springfield, some of the other ones that they paint a skyline, for instance, of Chicago on the side of the airplane. Cartoon characters, Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, Daffy Duck, all were very popular during the war. So it was really anything that the flight crew came up with. Maybe it was the nickname of the pilot, something like that, but it was something that connected the crew with that airplane.
Well, so this is really the exhibit on display at EAA. This is really just the nose art, right? What happened to the rest of the airplanes?
It's interesting. After the war, there were so many airplanes that they were scrapped. They were used as target practice. They were chopped up. They were melted down. Whatever happened to them, they were disposed of in a lot of ways. And so all of these airplanes ended up in Arkansas. And there was a man, worked for the railroad there, got the contract to salvage these airplanes for scrap metal. And he took a liking to some of the nose art, and that's really where the story began.
He just had the foresight to chop the art off of the nose and do whatever with the rest of the airplane?
Well, there's, again, a story behind that, too. And there are two of them. We're not sure which one is actually true, if either of them. But he liked some of the paintings, especially of the girls and the girlfriends and things like that. And the two stories are, one, that he also owned a hog farm in Arkansas, and he wanted to build a fence for his hog farm. And so this would make great fencing, good solid metal fencing all the way around. The other story is his wife often had many of the society ladies of the town there in Arkansas over to their house. He didn't care for that much. And so what he wanted to do was put up something that would scare the ladies away and they wouldn't come back. Now, I don't know if either of those stories are true, but they're really good stories.
They're excellent stories,
and
yes.
Part of the legend, but he took those nose art panels off the airplanes. The rest of the airplanes were scrapped. And so he cut them off with axes, with welding torches, with chainsaws at times. So if you come up to Oshkosh to the EA Museum and look at these, you'll see indentations, and they started to cut and went, no, we're hitting a hard surface here. We have to move over here and cut some more. And it's fascinating to see not only the story of the airplane, but the story of how these panels were preserved.
Right. I was going to say, this is on one hand not the way a museum would have removed the nose art, but at the same time, it seems like that becomes part of the story as well.
It is. You know, and he never did build that fence, by the way. It never got done. But he stored
the pigs
them.
Are just running around.
They're now, yeah. Loose and feral pigs throughout Arkansas, apparently. But it was one of those things that he stored them all and had them for a couple of decades. And finally, he was getting up there in years in the early 70s, and his son went, Dad, these are incredible. Now, 30 years after the war, people are looking at these and going, this is wonderful stuff. You should donate this to somebody. And fortunately, there's a group called the Commemorative Air Force that's based in Texas that is dedicated to the preservation of World War II aircraft and the entire culture of that, of the air machines of that war. And they received all of these and put them in their museum in Midland, Texas, basically unrestored at the time and so forth, just put them up there. And they were there in the museum for quite a while. And then it just weather and years and everything else caused them to come down, and they had to restore them. So they took the panels and spec by spec, restoration artists actually redid the panels. And you see what they are today, and they're well-preserved, as well-preserved as a hunk of B-17 bomber can be.
Well, they're well-preserved, but they were in the hands of the Commemorative Air Force. How did they end up in the collection of the EAA for the time they're here?
Yeah, they're on loan because the Commemorative Air Force is moving from Midland, Texas. They're planning to build a grand new museum just south of Dallas, and they're in the fundraising phase right now, and which means as they move all the materials, most of what they have are airplanes, so they're going in hangars. Well, these are items you just don't want to stack against a wall in a hangar someplace. So they started offering them around, and they asked us, since we have the museum in Oshkosh, do you want these for a while? And so we said, sure. So last November, we received them. Six semi-trucks came up with not only the panels, more than 30 panels, but the stands and all the interpretive pieces about each of the units and each of the airplanes that come up, and there they were. And so we had them throughout 2016, and we've just learned that it's been extended through at least August of next year. So folks who haven't seen it yet in your area certainly should come up and take a look at those up in Oshkosh.
They are officially a Save America's Treasures project for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Does that mean that these artifacts are in danger in some way?
Well, not so much in danger, but they're extremely rare. There are very few actual panels from the World War II airplanes that are left. A lot of restorations out there. People take a piece of aluminum or whatever, steel, and bend it and make it look like Noah's Ark, and then we'll recreate Noah's Ark. We have some of those along our walls in EAA as well. But these are the originals off the airplanes. And the stories of the airplanes themselves are as fascinating as the stories of the pieces of art today.
What a terrific story. Dick Nepinski, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dick Nepinski is Communications Director for the Experimental Aircraft Association in Oshkosh. The Noah's Art exhibit is on display at the EAA Air Venture Museum through 2017. You can see pictures of some of the art on display at WUWM.com. Our interview first aired last month.
One last break, but when we come back, we'll look at the unique history of a Milwaukee icon, the ceramic house number tiles here. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bubbler Talk is on vacation for the month of January, but that doesn't mean we're done answering your questions. Throughout the month, we'll be bringing you conversations that take a deep dive into the culture and history of the Cream City.
If you've ever walked around the city, you might have noticed the distinctive tiles adorning some of the older homes in town. They're small white ceramic with a black font, and they're fairly standard. If you're like our listener, Dan Osterud, you may be curious about how they came to be.
Dan asked, why are all the house numbers in the city of Milwaukee the same? All one style of ceramic tile. Was this type of number required by law?
Well, not exactly by law, but as writer Matthew Prigge explored in his Milwaukee Magazine article on the subject, the house numbers were distributed by the city. Prigge stopped by to talk about his research into the iconic house numbers and the inspiration for his investigation.
I'd been for years just noticing the address tiles. You know, every building I lived in had them. They were all over the place. And after a few years of kind of casually noticing them, I decided to actually look into this and see, you know, what the story was, because they were very unique to this area, and it's something, being here and seeing them every day, you kind of take for granted. But as I started to notice them more, I wanted to find out why specifically these are both everywhere here and kind of local to this part of the state.
So we'll go into the actual story behind the tiles in just a moment, but how did you go about searching for this, for the answer?
Well, the old Google News Archive was very helpful. Some people know that they've recently taken all the old Milwaukee Journal and Sentinel archives down from there, but back when that was still active, you could keyword search, and through that I found some dates and some other relevant terms and found that it connected to another number of other issues in city history.
So what did you find?
Well, the address tiles actually came from this drive to standardize the city's house numbering system, which by the teens was becoming something of a problem. Before that, the house numbering and the street names had been kind of done haphazardly as the city grew. So there was no real system or rhyme or reason to it. You know, the idea of the 100 block or the 200 block wasn't something that was here yet. In fact, a number of streets had multiple house numbers on the same street. So 500 Main Street might be two or three different actual locations on that street. So it was driving everybody crazy, especially delivery boys and then people deliver telegrams. So the city wanted to kind of get everybody on the same page with this and create a, you know, an east and west and north and south boundary. Well, part of this would have necessitated actually renumbering, physically renumbering all these houses. And they knew that they needed to provide these address tiles, the numbers to people or to, you know, to get everybody to do this and to have this system take over. But there was, well, about 15 years of bickering as to how to actually pay for these tiles, where to buy them, how to do this. So the idea lingered for a long time until finally in the late 20s when they finally began to actually make some progress on doing this all.
And this kind of comes amid similar pushes in other cities to standardize the streets. How did they decide to do that in Milwaukee?
In Milwaukee, finally in 1930, they decided that the Milwaukee River and Clinton Street would be the new east-west boundaries, and the Menominee Valley and Canal Street would be the north-south boundaries, and that was geographically at the time split the city pretty evenly up into four areas, and just went out from there. You know, the northwest, north and south, east and west streets grew out of that. Before that, it was, you know, some streets had a direction, some didn't, and then from there too, you get the, you know, the addresses. 100 West Wisconsin is right across the river. Same thing with 100 East Wisconsin, and from the valley outward as well. So they decided on that, and then actually, that was in the late 20s, and then again, a few more years to actually figure out where they're going to buy all these tiles and how they were going to get everybody to give up the, you know, piecemeal system they'd known and make this pretty drastic change over to the new system.
Why did they decide on tiles instead of something maybe more common, like, you know, those pewter letters that you often see on buildings?
Well, they actually considered a number of different options. One of the local options, this, of course, by 1930, when they're doing this, you have the Depression starting to make itself known locally. And there was a big push to keep this order local. And one of the local firms was actually going to make metal tiles, cast iron tiles that would have been actually cheaper than what they ended up going with. But the common council who was in charge of giving out this bid actually put a lot of thought into this and wanted something that was going to be long-lasting and highly visible and aesthetically pleasing. And they ended up going with the tile for a number of those reasons.
And it seems like they put these tiles through a number of different, I don't want to say insane tests, but they did put it through a large battery, the tiles through a large battery of tests.
Yeah, it was, reading the newspaper articles back at the time, they kind of make this joke about how when the Common Council, because this was $50,000 project. But they made this joke that when the Common Council gets a contract this big, they, you know, they really take their time because they want to get as many local business people to curry favor with them as possible, and they want to feel like big shots for a little while. But they actually, you know, took this the address tile thing very seriously. They tested with a number of the samples, the tiles that they're considering. They looked at them from different angles. They put different lights on them to see how visible they were. They boiled the tiles. They froze them overnight. They dropped steel balls on them just to make sure that they could withstand the rigors of, you know, summer and winter in the city, and I guess, I don't know, hail, I suppose. But they really made sure that they got exactly what they wanted.
So the hope being that even if your house burns down, those tiles will still be there.
Yes, yes. And I think just the testament to the process back then was that there's still so many of these around today, and they are, there's nothing else from the 30s that is still so prominent around the city.
So how many of these tiles were actually made for the city of Milwaukee?
The first order, I think, was about 600,000 tiles. And that is, that covered about 160,000 addresses. And at the same time, Shorewood and Whitefish Bay also, a lot of the suburbs, too, followed the same kind of addressing system that the city used. Eventually, all of them jumped onto that. But some of the other suburbs also ordered these. So I think there was about 600,000, 600,000 to 700,000 in total in the first batch. And as the city grew, they made a number of other, they reordered the tiles, you know, as the more houses were put up and more addresses needed to be assigned.
But we don't continue to do it.
I don't believe so. I don't think the city has any part in numbering houses. Now, there was never actually any kind of ordinance or law that said you needed to put up these tiles. There is, of course, you need to have an address number visible, and it needs to be, you know, visible, whatever the standards of that are. But there's nothing, even when they were handing these out, there was nothing that said specifically you needed to use these. They just used this as kind of a way to, you know, they went around handing them out, and most people put them up because what everybody else is doing. So it's kind of a motive to get people to readdress. But there was never anything specifically that said you needed to use these. So I don't believe the city. I know for a while I've heard anecdotally you used to be able to buy kind of knockoffs of these tiles at hardware stores, you know. But that was a while ago. So I'm not sure how people. I think they're all left to their own devices now.
So how many do we know about? How many are still left?
I really have no idea. I mean, that would be, I couldn't say. You'd have to go around and look at how many of the houses are still standing, because I think that was the one thing that the most likely thing to get them out of circulation was a house being torn down or being rebuilt. But you still see them on most of the older houses.
Well, that's the next story, right?
Yeah. I'll go around and do a canvas.
Go around, count the tiles on each house. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Matthew Prigge is a freelance writer based in Milwaukee. His piece, A Font for Us, was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. For more information on that and to check out some of our previous Bubbler Talk pieces, head to WUWM.com. And that's Friday's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The producers of Lake Effect include me and Joy, plus Audrey Nowakowski and Bonnie North, and the expert assistance of Mayan Silver.
We get additional reporting from Rachel Morello and Susan Bentz, web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.